The Monday Morning Tech Chat Show is brought to you by Audible. Audible is, of course, the premier audiobook service, perfect for folks who want their books read to them. Thousands and thousands of titles to choose from in all genres, sci-fi, fantasy, biographies, history, thrillers, mysteries, and more. We've got a great offer for listeners on this podcast, 2 free audiobooks when you sign up. And those books are yours to keep even if you decide to cancel your Audible subscription, which is $14.95 a month and gives you a free book every month of your choosing, as well as some other fun perks. Membership has its privileges. Hit up bit.ly/geekbookclub to start your free trial and get those 2 free books on lock. Once again, bit.ly/geekbookclub. And now, let's get into the show. Okay, I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, my camera is off. I'm just going to twist. Welcome to another Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm doing it live. I am Juan Carlos Bagnell, some gadget guy, the SGG of this terribly named podcast series, Q&A. The QA stands for the fact that we like to make this an interactive live discussion, starting our week off right. Spending a little more time digging through the news of last week, anything that broke over the weekend, sorting out our feels on it, and covering a variety of topics so we can start our week off fresh. And I'm already seeing a phenomenal live chat. Aditya Anil, Gary the Fireman, Matt Tyler, Abraham Artemis, Charlie Spirit Song, Hella Bro, what's up? So we're going to have a fun conversation here. I'm seeing some other people too. A couple stragglers. I see, I think there's like one folk over on Periscope, and I'm seeing a Mixer stream pop up. So again, you know, don't be shy. Contribute to the live chat. I'm trying to watch everything as it's coming in live. This has been a heck of a week. Now, I almost considered postponing the podcast because today is Pixel 4 embargo day, and now everyone is rushing out to tell you how they're correct in the Pixel 4 not being worth its enough for the monies. Seeing a lot of like backhanded compliments like, well, I mean, it does this really well, but, you know, maybe if that's what you're into, that's the one person who should buy this phone. I contributed to that onslaught of noise. We're going to have to jump into some housekeeping here. But it's just been interesting to me to watch how sort of popularity algorithms and the influence over phone manufacturers that do a better job of advertising, for example, or have been around as long as higher profile players in this space for a longer period of time. The general perception of what constitutes value. I put out a video on the Pixel 4 just focused on performance because I've only had the phone for a long weekend. I got it Thursday night. It's not enough time to put out a full review. And I'm kind of watching through a few channels that I know were in similar situations, but they're trying to leverage embargo day to talk about a product, to talk about a phone. And, you know, it's tricky. We move the goalposts a lot as content creators. As tech reviewers, I should say, when we're looking at what's going to appeal to an audience, what features do we focus on so that people feel good or enjoy and share the videos that we put out. And so my take on the Pixel 4 so far was just I wanted to focus on what could the phone really do, considering it's a premium, expensive phone. So we're going to get into that in the second half of the show, really chatting up what's going on with Pixel 4. Let's jump into some housekeeping because I've already seen what is the over-under. I've seen someone, Gary the Fireman says 12 minutes for housekeeping. Charlie saying 17 to 18 minutes. Abraham Artemis is going with 20 minutes. All right, let's see. I'm going to cue this up. I've got my window screen share on. I've got the first story lined up at 9:04 Pacific Standard Time. And okay. Over the last week, we had a lot of stories that I wanted to kind of keep my hands on the pulse. And then also, I'm going to start trying to incorporate more written editorials into my workflow just because doing everything in video, not sustainable. Talked about this in the state of the Patreon. If you're on the Patreon, I do a monthly live stream just sort of coordinating what we're going to be doing over the next month. And there's so many things, so many more things that I want to be talking about that I want to be covering. I can't shoot video for all of them. So getting into a screen share here, we go. One of the things that I wanted to talk a little bit more about was the ongoing issues with Samsung's fingerprint sensor specifically. We covered this on the podcast last week that the Galaxy S10 has a problem where they've acknowledged that it's a problem where the software backing up the fingerprint sensor can be tricked by putting a piece of plastic over the fingerprint sensor. And I'm getting a little frustrated with the arguments of improvements on ultra premium phones and the lifestyle arguments that are being made. I don't see where, you know, going to an in-display fingerprint sensor has displaced the traditional hardware dedicated fingerprint sensors. I'm on the Pixel 4. I'm having a philosophical issue with face unlock being the only biometric solution available. And when we talk about the variety of different products out there, you know, a waterfall or a wraparound display makes a phone look really pretty. It's not the most practical design for a lifestyle, put it in your pocket or purse companion computer. So this is a pretty cranky rant. Software design improvements are not progress. Prettier is less practical. We're forcing a lot of consumer compromises on our expensive pocket smartphone computers just to make something look a little bit niftier. We demand like cool futuristic tech every year, but it's not necessarily better. Gestures on Android, I don't think are better than navigation buttons. Gestures on the iPhone, I don't think are better than a home button. They just look a little more futuristic. And then you get used to them. You didn't really get a better, a more ergonomic solution. So if you want to take a read through that, I'm going to be writing more of these style of lifestyle editorials on tech. I've got a couple articles penned for the Pixel 4. A lot of people complaining about value and worth, and I feel like that's a written topic. I don't necessarily need to go running into YouTube with more videos just to make people angry. Whenever I say nice things about the Pixel 4, people get angry enough. Same thing with LG. If I say something nice about an LG, I'll have a bunch of Samsung Knights telling me why I'm wrong. So the next one up, this was the video I put out the day most people got their Pixel 4s. I thought this was hilarious. I don't know that people really thought this was as funny as I thought it was, but my Pixel 4 got delayed. The shipping got delayed by a day. Apparently, this was a huge brouhaha with Viper having an issue with shipping on his product, too. And he's had numerous live streams about, like, getting phones for free, and it's not really for free, and what is free? And I'm mad at UPS, and oh, I shouldn't be complaining about things online. Instead of complaining about my phone being delayed a day, I made a video about a flip phone. I was like, I wanted to have a video out. So to combat the all of the unboxing videos on the Pixel 4, I took a look at the Alcatel Smart Flip. This is a flip phone review. I was very surprised by the user experience. Now, I had been using this phone for a couple days. It wasn't like I just, oh, well, I didn't have my Pixel 4, I'll make a video on a flip. Excuse me. I'd actually had the phone for a couple days beforehand. I was just kind of playing around with it. I was getting ready to do some Pixel stuff, and I thought, oh, well, this will be the video that wraps up the month. Instead, I kind of pushed it a little bit ahead to make up for my Pixel omission. This is my first experience with Kai OS. If you're not familiar, Kai OS is a very streamlined feature phone operating system that has surged in popularity in India and around the world, especially in regions of the world where we're talking about sort of maybe like a lower economic status or just now emerging into 3G and 4G infrastructure. I was really expecting this to be, I had used the Alcatel Flip like 2 years ago. I think I did a review on it for Pocket Now. And yeah, it was just sort of a normal flip phone. But what Alcatel is doing now is they're using this feature phone operating system to improve a basic flip phone experience. And so you get all of the perks of owning a flip phone, like multi-day battery life, you know, 2 weeks of standby time. It's got an LTE radio. You can, I believe on T-Mobile, I don't think you can on AT&T, but you can use it as a Wi-Fi hotspot. And hilariously, it's my favorite joke of the video that it comes with more Google services than a Huawei Mate 30. So you flip it open and there's your Google Assistant and YouTube. You can plug in your email. It's got a little app store. I believe it's got WhatsApp support. I know I was tweeting from it. And I was very surprised when I handed it to my daughter that as soon as she figured out the big center button, you know, the big button in the middle of the phone could be used to activate the Google Assistant, then to her, it wasn't much different than any other smart device. I pushed the button, I talked to it, and then it played Baby Shark for me, and everything is right in the world. So, again, this was kind of a fun week for Juan getting surprised by products because I was expecting this to be kind of a sillier video. Oh, you could use a flip phone. Oh, it's for your grandfather. There's now in my brain a more legit argument for a streamlined, smart feature phone approach, especially with some of the criticism I'm going to have with Pixel 4 reviews, people saying like, again, moving the goalposts around like, oh, well, this phone doesn't have 4K video at 60 frames per second, but average consumers need these types of features. And you're like, well, those are exclusive. You know, if you're talking about average consumers and daily driver use, you're not talking about advanced content creation and laptop displacement. So it's okay to have different categories of criticism. If you're looking at just a streamlined LTE device that has basic Google services, Google Maps, YouTube, search, you could do worse. It's a fun fight between Android Go devices and that KaiOS flip phone. So moving right along, when I did finally get my Pixel 4, I wanted to do something a little different for the first impressions. Instead of from Mayan KT11 on Periscope, with no major breakthrough happening in battery tech in the near future, maybe toned down features. Talking about a feature phone, I got a number of comments on that smart flip from people saying, oh, this is kind of what I'd want, a more streamlined phone, and then I could use it to power, you know, the data connection to my laptop when I really want to sit down and work. I made that, again, I was making jokes in that video. A few folks chimed in to say that maybe that was legit use. Okay, back to the Pixel 4. Instead of just a straight up first impressions, you know, like, oh, I pulled it out of the box and the box opens up really nice and it feels really good in the hand and square camera. Ooh, because this phone has been leaked to death, I didn't really feel like we needed another one of those videos. So instead, I did a predictions video. So for the Pixel 4, after 4 times 4 hours of use, I wrote up my top 4 hopes and my top 4 fears of the Pixel 4 XL. It's fours. And it's for you to watch, for your enjoyment, the number 4. I'm happy to report that one of my predictions was already incorrect. One of my main hopes of the phone, already proven wrong. And we'll talk about that a little bit more into the second half of the podcast. We're really going to dig into the Pixel 4 stuff. That kind of leads me into my last bit of housekeeping here. Web browser. Google Pixel 4 XL benchmarked the fastest phone of 2019. Again, I've only had the phone for 3 full days. I refuse to put out anything called a review with only 3 days of use. I try not to put out reviews until I know that the phone has had at least one solid consumer software update, not just a day zero patch for reviewers. Because there was a, if you were seeing some of the early videos, it was before like a little 30 megabyte patch had been pushed out, tweaked just a few settings on the phone. I don't know what it really changed because I installed it as soon as I turned my phone on. But I really want to see, like, what is Google's first major software update polish up? And that's when I try to get on, now it's time to really review the phone. This is what the consumer experience would actually resemble. That always backfires for me on a OnePlus, because OnePlus is constantly putting out these maintenance updates because they put out phones that are a little rough around the edges when they're brand new out of the box, but we've now built up some trust that they will actually address and fix problems. We've got a couple software update stories coming in the news block, LG and Samsung, for example. So it's always kind of a balance. I want to see what Google addresses in their first major platform update. There are some things that need fixing on the Pixel 4 XL. But what doesn't need fixing, and will probably also get a little bit better as the phone does get some maintenance and some polish, this is maybe the fastest phone of 2019. I was shocked at the actual performance that you can get out of a Pixel 4 when the benchmarks are kind of lame. So I put that video out. I'm already getting a lot of people. Actually, I have to say, the initial impression has been overwhelmingly positive, because I think there are more than a few Pixel fans out there that are looking for commentary on the phone beyond here's why you shouldn't buy the phone. So not like I'm going to turn my channel into a Pixel channel, but I think there are a few folks who are finding it refreshing just to have a slightly different conversation about this device other than, it doesn't have this one thing that I like on another phone, so it's a deal breaker. They probably won't be as happy with my full review, but we'll save that for later into the show. So that wraps up housekeeping. I've got other things too, but those were the major topics. Those are the major things I wanted to showcase and to show off. I'm going to have a lot of stuff coming out over the next 2 weeks. This week is my daughter's birthday week, so I'm going to be a little quieter this week because we've got a ton of fun birthday activities planned leading right up into Halloween. And this is becoming like the best week of the year for my wife and I. Our daughter's birthday leads like right into Halloween. So she is already becoming a little goth toddler, and it's adorable and it's awesome. So be on the lookout for other topics. I have no idea what's going to be coming out on the channel this week, but I think in housekeeping, oh, Elias too, happy birthday to her. Some Gadget, we need a good nickname for Lex. So my wife is like Some Gadget wife. We need like, I don't know, Some Gadget gal. Is that how we should talk, you know, refer to my daughter? Anyway, Some Gadget daughter. That's a good one. I like Chatty from Chatty Boy. Sorry, I'm going to be a little scattered. I was up over the weekend. Some Gadget kid. Some Gadget pixie. Oh, I kind of like that because she is like this little force of nature. Okay. Lots of stories, lots of topics. SomeGadgetGuy.com is where everything's going to live. And if you haven't been following on the blog, you might want to consider just checking in from time to time, maybe throw it into some kind of RSS reader or something like that, just because, like I said, I'm going to be trying to work a bit more on the written review side and not putting everything up into video on YouTube. Again, we've talked about this on the podcast before, but I've dragged housekeeping out even longer. So I didn't make 12 minutes, but I think I still bested the estimate that we were going to go to 20. Let's get into some news. Some pixie lawyer girl. Elias too, some gothic gal. No, I mean, just for October, because she's already really into creepy, spooky things. Like, she loves vampires and mummies and werewolves and witches. We went to the pumpkin patch. There's a little teeny tiny farm over by the 101 here, Tapia Bros. And she wanted to wear this headband that had a teeny tiny little witch's cap on it. It was pretty adorable. Abraham Artemis is being very kind in saying that housekeeping was 14 minutes. All right. We got quite a bit to cover in the news block before we get into gadgets. So let me try and move through this a bit more economically. If you have questions, if you have debate points, Pixel 4, I know a lot of people want to fight me already on YouTube, I've gotten a bunch of comments like, well, it couldn't possibly be worth it for the monies. And for this price, it's completely outlandish. Have those questions at the ready. I would like to have an interactive conversation about the Pixel 4 because I was very critical of Pixel 3. I was very surprised by Pixel 3a, and Pixel 4 is kind of landing me somewhere in between. But I think there are some good conversation points to be had about value for money in the consumer electronics space and why tech YouTubers might not be the best resources anymore to have those conversations, myself included. So let's get in. Aditi Anil, is she like that goth vampire from Hotel Transylvania? It's hilarious that you brought that up. She has been watching the Hotel Transylvania movies like on a nonstop loop because it's Halloween time. So I'm almost off book memorizing all of the dialogue from Hotel Transylvania 1 through 3. All right. News. Let's get into some news. I think we've always got room on our plate for a little Facebook trashing. This is coming by way of commondreams.org. Again, all of the articles that we're going to be talking about today, I'm going to have in the show notes when the audio version of the podcast goes live. You can catch that on somegadgetguy.com. We have a few folks, especially when the video version goes over to YouTube, that are doing amazing work. Charlie Spirit Song has been putting up time codes with links attached so you can get through the topics we talk about. But commondreams.org, as Zuckerberg defends false Trump ads as free expression, critics say Facebook's assault on foundations of democracy must be stopped. This is written up by Jessica Corbett. Amid the ongoing debate over Facebook's policy of exempting political advertising from its misinformation standards, a defiant speech on free expression delivered Thursday by Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has elevated broader concerns about how powerful tech giants are poisoning the well of our democracy. You know, Facebook's recent revision of its political ad policy, first reported on earlier this month by journalist Judd Legum in his newsletter Popular Information, enables political figures such as President Donald Trump to widely circulate lies and has elicited criticism from other politicians like Democratic presidential primary candidates, former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Elizabeth Warren. This is a story that we've been touching on, that we've been covering loosely over the last several months, actually over the last year. And I really feel this is one of those instances where the tech industry and the tech community, the Facebooks, the Googles, the Amazons, they really need to look at consistently, especially the Twitters, consistently enforcing their internal policy, lest we overreact with some kind of regulatory response. Facebook, very much, Zuckerberg and Facebook very much enjoy this dual status that they've been able to maintain. They claim they are not responsible for the content that is posted on their platform, but they do maintain editorial control over content which might upset advertisers. So either they're a publication, which they should have the same regulatory responsibilities as like a newspaper or like a TV news station, or they shouldn't be able to touch anything, and the content and commentary on their platform would likely be garbage and full of just terrible misinformation. Increasingly, Facebook has become a distribution center, not unlike TV news, with other services attached to it. It's really rough stuff. There isn't a great answer. You don't want to silence speech, but then you also can't really claim the same kinds of free speech protections if you're also looking at manipulating what viewers on your platform see. This is new territory. Our law doesn't really quite cover what social media is, not in any kind of traditional sense. It's very different than a radio broadcast or a television broadcast, especially in the way that content can be manipulated in real time. Your feed is not a real-time feed of stuff being shared. It's manipulated to try and keep you on the platform for as long as possible. So while I agree with Zuckerberg in the sort of the truest sense of freedom of speech, he operates a private platform. His platform is not a public platform for discourse. It's a private institution. And we should be very concerned about how governments regulate private institutions. But if they can't self-police their content, then as the citizenry of this country, really our only solution is kind of a terrible solution, but we've got to enact some kind of enforcement. So I would hope that these are early warning signs, especially to the rest of Silicon Valley, that we've got to come up with some better system. There needs to be better transparency. There needs to be much better consistency in enforcement. And how you take ad dollars does reflect the tone of your corporation. So if you're taking ad dollars from super PACs that basically lie about political candidates, that says a lot about the character of your company. I mean, we want it to be open and we want speech to be free, but that's starting to get really gross. From Zal Botnick, I understand Zuckerberg's point. I mean, there is the line. Should they also stop discussions by people who discuss fake news like it's real news? GW deniers on there are in a bubble. I don't know GW deniers. George, I don't know what GW is. And informing each other is the same as those fake ads. And then hella, bro. Facebook is the doo-doo. Oh, and LFA Reviews is joining the chat. Everyone should be following LFA Reviews if you like your ears. If you hate your ears and you want to only feed your ears garbage, and you want to have a hearing aid when you're in your late 20s, then don't follow LFA Reviews. If you do follow LFA Reviews, then you'll probably be exposed to headphone reviews that will make your mission of destroying your ears much more difficult. Charlie Spirit Song, remember the congressional hearing that dragged Facebook some time ago? Zuckerberg's responses in that were infuriating. I don't see any differences now. It's rough stuff. What's interesting is a handful of politicians are getting a lot savvier. We still have so far to go, from state and local officials all the way up to our federal representatives. These are just the first steps, but that's also why I'm so concerned. I'm concerned that if the industry can't self-police, that our response will be an overcorrection. When we face the Trump administration talking about trying to police social media, that doesn't sound a whole lot different than someone like Beto O'Rourke also talking about ways that we can police online content. They're coming at it from, in my opinion, they're coming at it from very different intentions. And I feel Beto is probably being more honorable, but the actual execution matters. And that's where I don't feel they would be phenomenally different tool sets. Then the tool being operated by a politician with honorable intentions is different than that same tool being used by a politician with nefarious intentions. So I would wholeheartedly recommend giving this Common Dreams article a read. It's a much longer examination, digging into a lot of the quotes. It's very well researched. It's very well sorted, cited. And it's something that's increasingly going to be a divisive political topic, especially for us tech fans. I know there's like a very libertarian streak in tech enthusiasm, but this is where we also need to get after those market leaders that might not be operating with the best of intentions. Matt Tyler, hashtag some politics news guy. Tech is politics right now, man. I wish we could avoid it. I wish we had the luxury of not paying attention to this stuff. But man, there's some gross stuff happening. And that's also where this next story, I kind of want to throw a thumbs up, because this is exciting investigative law enforcement from an organization that I think most Americans hate, Story number two, IRS followed Bitcoin transactions resulting in takedown of the largest child exploitation site on the web. This is from Forbes.com, written up by Kelly Phillips Erb. Let me take a drink of water here real quick. I just got a sip. Sorry for the ASMR here. All right, from the article, the largest dark web child pornography site in the world has been taken down. That was the word today from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia, the Justice Department's Criminal Division, the IRS Criminal Investigation, the IRSCI, and U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement's Homeland Security Investigations, HSI, together with the National Crime Agency of the UK and Republic of Korea at a joint press conference announcing arrests and forfeitures. That was a lot of words to say. But again, let me scroll down just an extra paragraph here. IRSCI was able to trace Bitcoin transactions on the site to people all over the world who were uploading and downloading this material, as well as find the location of the site administrator by analyzing the blockchain and de-anonymizing Bitcoin transactions. The agency was able to identify hundreds of predators around the world, even though those users thought they could remain anonymous. So all of these politicians ranting and railing about systems needing backdoors and ending encryption, and we've created this end run around the banking industry with blockchain technologies and this Bitcoin. Abraham Artemis actually totally nails this. When it comes to money, no one messes with the IRS. If there is money that should be taxed and you aren't a billionaire, then they will come for it. This is an amazing story on a number of fronts. This is exactly the cat and mouse game that I feel should take place with technology. Was it last week or 2 weeks ago? We talked about New York law enforcement has been able to crack open iPhones for a couple years now. So there are arguments about forcing Apple to build a backdoor into the iPhone. Totally, totally suspect. They've already been able to get to this information. They supposedly needed help from Apple to get into. I always feel consumers should have access to the best possible tools to protect their own data, to protect their privacy. We never know who's going to be in charge and who's going to leverage a tool built with the best of intentions against people that they might disagree with. I think our current presidential administration is probably a pretty good example of someone who would likely not use tools like that with the best of intentions. So when we start seeing, but the flip side of that is I feel like law enforcement should always be trying to build a better battering ram. I've always used the clumsy metaphor, like I shouldn't have to give my keys to my local police station in case they might need to search my home. But if they serve a warrant and I don't let them in, then they should be able to knock that door down. I feel like technology should be handled in a similar philosophical fashion. So here we've built these systems of moving money around and they can be exploited in a way that we find reprehensible. Money, I mean, just pure paper cash, can also be spent on reprehensible activities, but there is a certain disturbing ease of facilitating disturbing activities when we start talking about things like Bitcoin. That doesn't mean we get rid of Bitcoin, and that doesn't mean we regulate Bitcoin in a way so that it works exactly like, you know, money in our society, that it's just another credit card transaction or something like that. We use law enforcement to do better investigative reporting and in better criminal investigations to track that stuff down. And this is radical that the IRS, in coordination with a number of other law enforcement agencies around the world, has found a way to de-anonymize blockchain transactions is huge. I am shocked that this actually hasn't been a bigger story in our sort of our mainstream media, because we saw all of the doom and gloom and the horror and, oh, people are using Bitcoin to buy the drugs. This is kind of like, from everything that was explained to me about how Bitcoin was supposed to function, something like this was not really supposed to be possible. But at least it is being used in, I think, something that we would all agree is one of the noblest endeavors facing our planet today, is finding a way to hammer people that are engaging in child exploitation. So this is another great write-up, well-cited, well-sourced, and just breaking down the points how we came to cracking all of this over the last 2 years. This is an exciting story. This is an exciting topic to talk about. So I hope you'll, again, aside from my ramblings on it, I hope you'll go and read at least this Forbes article, if not some of the other write-ups that have happened. This is now, again, it has been covered. I just wish it was getting more visibility. We're talking terabytes of child pornography videos. And also I've got to share this image right here. Sorry for those of you listening after the fact on the audio transcription, but for one of the sites that got shut down, welcome to video. This hidden site has been seized as part of a law enforcement operation by the United Kingdom, United States, Germany, and Republic of Korea. With cooperation from our international partners, arrests have taken place in all of these countries. They just put up this banner after they shut down a dark web site trafficking in child pornography. I feel like they earned their little pat on the back there. It's deep in the weeds. We're talking blockchains and dark web and all of those scary tech topics. But this is a great write-up, and I couldn't be more excited about sort of the future tech cat and mouse that's going to take place after this. It's distressing that real lives are affected, and that people can be abused through the utilization of some of the things that empower the most, the happiest moments of my daily life. But to the same time, when we stop those that are trying to abuse these systems, that also makes for a really happy story at the same time. Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on rglowingrectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together. From Abraham Artemis, sometimes I wish there were people like Judge Dredd handling those kinds of people. Again, I don't really feel like too many of us would disagree with that sentiment in a live stream like this. Abraham Artemis, if the IRS can get Al Capone, they can get you. I mean, like, I'm laughing. Like, I pay my taxes and I swear at the IRS every year. Actually, every quarter, because I have to file quarterly. But if you're telling me that my IRS and tax dollars are going towards these types of initiatives, I'm happy to pay those taxes. And from Zalbotnik, it's freaking scary how many of these sites are out there. The thing that's freaky about one of these stories, and again, I don't think that this article, it's not really the place in this article to bring that up, but they shut down some major operations. And that means that we're going to see a proliferation of smaller, deeper, darker communities start to pop up for people to get their fix on this. And that's horrific. But again, I like that they're making a show out of this, and I like that they're going after the money. the fact that there's a financial incentive to share this type of content, make it painful. Make it painful. Make it hurt for those people that are profiting off of this kind of activity. Yeah, I like making an example out of those people. Let's move into some happier tech gadget news. Matt Tyler, this stream took a dark turn, and we're going to turn out of some of that darkness. But I had to talk about that last story. But I agree. Hang the bastards, all of them. Yeah, we absolutely should. Oh, whoops, I'm still on the same link. I wanted to share this one because this is a fun article about one of the absolute best products ever made in the realm of wearable technology. iFixit has a beautiful write-up on the Pebble smartwatch and how people are trying to keep them running long after the company has basically folded. So this is written up by Kevin Purdy at iFixit. Rebel with a cause, how Pebble watches were granted an amazing afterlife. This is one of the most amazing love letters to one of my all-time favorite gadgets. I still have a Pebble Time. I did flash the Rebel, R-E-B-B-L-E, software. It's a community. Now the community, according to iFixit, 212,000 accounts. I'm one of them. I haven't pulled my Pebble out of my shoebox in a while. But the Pebble smartwatch, I think, is still the most successful companion device that's ever been built. Newer smartwatches do fancier things. They do flashier things. But what I loved about the Pebble is I put it on my wrist. The battery ran for a week. And it was one of the best streamlined interactions for getting notifications, alerts, and replies off of my phone and onto my wrist. That Pebble Time with speech-to-text transcription still has one of the best outdoor readable displays in all lighting conditions. I really don't think anything has bested the Pebble. The Apple Watch 5 is one of the best wearable computers, like putting a computer on your wrist. I absolutely believe that the Apple Watch experience is better than Android Wear or Samsung's Tizen smartwatch solution with the Gear. But with Apple Watch 5, they still can't keep an always-on timepiece display without absolutely wrecking your battery life. Like, even with some of the updates, you could get a week's worth of use on the Pebble. The only thing the Pebble was lacking, what they were going to address with the Pebble Time 2, was a heart rate sensor. I desperately wanted an all-day, always-on heart rate tracking, sleep tracking, and that we never got it. I had my money. I threw my money at them for their Kickstarter, and the company folded before they could finish production on the Pebble Time 2 heart rate edition, whatever they were going to call it. So iFixit has been following this community. They've written up this phenomenal article from where the company started, talking about some of their inspirations, some of those first videos showing the first Pebble in action. And after the company folded, how a community of people started trying to reverse engineer the software, make new firmware, make new updates, make a new app store, make all of the server side stuff. And to back that up, iFixit is now going to start supporting parts. So they've reached out to manufacturers who can 3D print the casings for the different Pebble smartwatches, and they're looking at where they can source things like the tiny little e-paper displays that went into Pebble smartwatches. And it's just this beautiful moment. We've talked about this on numerous episodes of the podcast. All of the companies that are making it more difficult to fix products, that are building more planned obsolescence into even more expensive gadgets. This is where, fill in the Galaxy Fold joke somewhere in here. That to see just a passionate community of developers, hardware enthusiasts, and then just, I want to wear a cool smartwatch and I want something that's a little bit different and I want it to run for as long as I can make it run. This is very encouraging. This is making me excited. Like, I'm going to go pull my Pebble back out of my shoebox my shoebox of old smartwatches and see, like, how has Rebel improved? Because as much as I like, Android, my Wear OS, my Tick Watch is right now the watch I turn to the most. If I could get most of that functionality in a watch that I only had to charge once a week and I could replace the battery and I could still do my speech to text replies to alerts and notifications, then that would be really cool as like a good backup. Because if I'm not wearing this, I'm usually wearing my Focals because that's the exciting bleeding edge of wearable technology. It would be nice to tag team like old school Pebble with new school Focals. And that's like how I make it through my day. So I loved this write-up. I fix it. If you also haven't been listening, they've got a great podcast. Like the beginning of every one of their podcasts is, well, what did you fix in your home this week? Well, I took apart my coffee grinder. Their podcast is great. So I'm really enjoying the content that they're putting out beyond just their teardowns. I mean, go to iFixit and watch them dismantle a phone. It's really cool watching them branch out and start covering other topics. From Matt Tyler, what are these Focals you speak of? Matt, this is like the most exciting tech accessory of the year. These are my smart glasses. You've seen my smart glasses, where I get the little heads up display on over my right eye, and I can scan through and speech to text reply and play little games and get walking directions served up right at eye level. I love those things. Okay. Sarcasm. Well, sarcasm doesn't work in a text live stream. All right, moving right along. Another happy story about the Pebble and Rebel and community of people keeping products alive longer. Another potentially scary story that is just now unfolding. I can't dig too deep into this. This is not my area of expertise, but I want to share this Twitter link and an R hacking post. This came by Mimranglot. It was shared in the Patreon Discord. And let me get this up here. The Some Gadget Guy Team SGG Patreon Discord. That's a really clumsy description of the Discord that we run on the Patreon. So this is some scary stuff if you were looking at software that could protect your identity online. Coming from @HexDefined. So apparently NordVPN was compromised at some point. Their expired private keys have been leaked, meaning anyone can just set up a server with those keys. This is running on localhost, I don't know any of this jargon or terminology. MITM, MITM attempt would look like. Of course, if the key was used before it had expired, there would be no warnings. As someone just mentioned to me, that past encrypted sessions may be able to be decrypted, which is a much bigger issue. So you use a VPN to try and protect your traffic online. It routes your traffic through another box, another server, and then that server tries to anonymize you online. At some point, and we haven't gotten, I can't find any confirmation on this story from major outlets. I haven't seen any reply from NordVPN just yet. Again, this is pretty fresh. This tweet was posted yesterday or the day before, and a lot of the replies happened 20 hours ago from the time this podcast was recorded, that we're now just starting to dig into what might be a very quiet security breach of a number of VPN providers. And NordVPN is one of the biggest and one of the most popular consumer solutions. You see them sponsoring YouTube videos all over the place. So I'm going to be linking to this Twitter thread. And then also there's, let me see if it's been updated at all. R hacking. There are a few comments coming in on R hacking. Breaking news just 20 minutes ago. Okay. Hold on. Let me pull up this webpage. Apparently there was, a reply from NordVPN. I missed it because it happened after I did my podcast prep here. Hold on. Let me screen share this and I'll link this in the show notes on this article too. I love it when we get breaking news on the podcast. from NordVPN. We have gathered all the data regarding the events of the last couple days. We understand the security concerns that arose from the information found online by security researchers and will address them in detail. We became aware that on March 2018, one of the data centers in Finland we had been renting our servers from was accessed with no authorization. The attacker gained access to the server by exploiting an insecure remote management system left by the data center provider while we were unaware that such a system existed. The server itself did not contain any user activity logs. None of our applications send user-created credentials for authentication, so usernames and passwords could not have been intercepted either. The exact configuration file found on the internet by security researchers ceased to exist on March 5, 2018. This was an isolated case, and no other data center providers we use have been affected. So they've got, and when they say that they've got a bit more information, there are about four or five more paragraphs here talking about the timeline, when the server was affected, when the breach was determined. The expired TLS key was taken at the same time the data center was exploited. However, the key couldn't possibly have been used to decrypt the VPN traffic of any other server. On the same note, the only possible way to abuse website traffic was by performing a personalized and complicated man-in-the-middle attack to intercept a single connection that tried to access NordVPN.com. So that to me sounds like it would be possible if you were doing a very personalized decrypting of an individual's network traffic. Not likely that someone would be able to take one of these expired keys, take some of these logs, and then unravel, sort of after the fact. You would have had to have, I think, attacked with forethought while that server had been compromised, if I'm reading that correctly. This last paragraph, very, very well stated from NordVPN. Again, they're kind of running a little damage control in their immediate response here. Even though only one of more than 3,000 servers we had at the time was affected, we are not trying to undermine the severity of the issue. We failed by contracting an unreliable server provider and should have done better to ensure the security of our customers. We are taking all the necessary means to enhance our security. We have undergone an application security audit and are working on a second no-logs audit right now and are preparing a bug bounty program. We will give our all to maximize the security of every aspect of our service, and next year we will launch an independent external audit all of our infrastructure to make sure we did not miss anything else. So, appropriate response. Very well positioned by NordVPN. Again, I kind of feel it's worth reiterating, especially after the story that we talked about, you know, taking down Bitcoin transactions through the IRS. I don't know that there is a foolproof security solution. If it's made by humans, it can probably be unraveled by humans. And you are the only judge of how much risk and how much protection you're likely to require given your own online activities. And nothing is completely secure and foolproof to maintain any notion of perfect security. From Gary the Fireman, we need a breaking news bumper. Yeah, we do. That would be awesome. I need like a whole soundboard. I'm way too overloaded right now to start coming up with, bumpers and graphics and tags, like a full broadcast package. Breaking news. Let's see. From Abraham Artemis, kudos to them. They were pretty open about all of this. That was a good response. I'm still going to be following. I don't use NordVPN. I kind of bounce between a couple different VPN providers when I travel, but I should, but I don't use anything at home. That might change. I don't know. We'll see. I've got three. Okay. One little story on battery life, two little stories on software updates, and then we're going to take a quick break to talk about the subreddit. But I'm sorry. If you're using a VPN, I think there should always be a buyer beware warning attached to any of your online activities. I would still highly recommend using some kind of VPN to protect your data online, but also know that there are always going to be situations outside of your control that can compromise your security. All right. LFA reviews. You got to talk to Travis MCP about the soundboard. He uses the Elgato Stream Deck. I have a good relationship with the folks over at Corsair. I should ask them, like, hey, what can we do about Stream Deck? All right. Here's in the, I wanted to post this story and just file it under, gadget articles. I want to file this under articles about confirming water is wet. How about that? Just off the top of my head. I need a bucket of, we made this article to confirm something that we kind of already knew. Coming by way of Engadget, written up by Steve Dent, tests show dark mode really can save battery life on OLED iPhones. Well, wouldn't you know it? Look at that. Phone Buff did this whole video where they used an iPhone with the light mode and an iPhone with the dark mode. And they found that dark mode saved them more battery. So at the end of the test, the light mode iPhone was dead, while the one running dark mode still had 30% of the battery remaining. That result is pretty good justification for switching if you often drain your iPhone's battery. Yeah. Matt Tyler, wait, so you're telling me dark mode saves battery by turning off the individual pixels? Who knew? I need to continue expressing. So it was before I had joined Pocket Now. We were all doing these like battery comparison, screen comparison types of articles. Because Holotheme was a mostly dark theme on Android, when we switched over to Material Design, it really bothered me how much of that UI could not be themed to be true dark theme, and how many of Google's services were blinding white. Like, it is so much nicer in mixed lighting conditions to use Google Calendar in dark mode, to use Gmail. I just got the Gmail. Gmail just flipped. To use Gmail in dark mode. It is so frustrating to come full circle on this when we already had the beginnings. The Holotheme. We had just started getting Galaxies and Nexus phones with OLED displays. But at least we're finally coming back to some consideration for that. Abraham Artemis, wow, I didn't know that can happen. Matt Tyler, iPhone, Apple invents the most amazing things. But I mean, the thing is, like, it kind of took the iPhone 11 bringing back a dark, it kind of took the iPhone 11 instituting a dark mode to put some pressure on Google to bring a dark mode back. Since Material had come out, we've been seeing Android betas with support for some kind of dark theme, and then it wouldn't materialize. And now with Android 10, we're finally getting it back. It is so pants-on-head dumb that this wasn't a part of an earlier Android build. And it's another example of Google doing something right initially, backing off from it, then Apple picking up that idea, and then Google looking like they're the copycat coming back to it. So it's, again, it's silly. But that is kind of surprising. I'm still always concerned about iPhone battery life. You know, I know the iPhone 11 Pro Max is supposed to have amazing battery life. But Apple, for their more efficient overall design, they don't really put in the best batteries for long-term use. and their phones throttle sooner, and they put you, after a year, they put you on that list of phones to degrade performance. So if you could save 30% of your battery life, most people are just going to use their phone more, but at least that should help stress on that battery cell. Oh, from Brayden. Yeah, Instagram is dark now on both. Twitter has lights out on Android now. I've been using the dark Twitter theme for a while, but I'll have to try lights out. The Instagram, that's another one. Like, you know, it's late at night and I get a notification and I go to tap it and then blinding white light right in my face. Any of that. Switch it. I want dark. I know you have issues with burn-in. It does seem to exacerbate, you know, UI elements getting burned into your OLEDs. But the overall user experience for me has been nicer on darker themes. Okay. So, two quick update stories. Good news for LG fans. LG made a lot of noise about making a software center. Building a little team of software developers that were supposed to improve the timeliness of LG updates. That really hasn't come to bat. I mean, I think they only announced this a year and a half ago. Was it 2 years ago? Someone correct me in the comments. I don't remember when LG actually said that they were going to make this center. It wasn't that long ago. But over the last year, I don't think anyone would say LG's timeliness for the major operating system updates have improved at all. In fact, from like Android 7 to Android 9, I think a lot of people would be inclined to say they've gotten worse at the major OS updates. The one thing I want to give them credit for, though, the individual maintenance updates have been shockingly good. So performance improvements, camera improvements, audio improvements, speaker improvements. My LG V50, the first week I had it, to getting the first Korean update, because I started with the Korean LG V50. Night and day. Much better phone. And that's where we got, you know, the LG G8 getting support for 60 frame per second 4K video with software stabilization. Again, if you follow SuperSAF, Apple invented that, except for the fact that the LG G8 had it before the iPhone came out. Those types of improvements are very encouraging that hopefully we'll see the same level of polish and the same level of improvement for their operating system updates. And I'm also hoping that at some point they take a look at their UI and really clean up their launcher, because LG's launcher is one of the worst in the business, in the market. I can't recommend an LG phone without immediately saying, oh, and put Nova Launcher on it. So what's exciting for me is seeing that we're going to get an LG's Android 10 beta sometime this month. That still puts them behind Samsung. We're still lagging real bad behind Galaxies. I believe the Galaxy S10 has an open Android 10 beta. I know they pushed the launch of the actual consumer update back, but Samsung is still ahead there. But we should see the LG G8, then the LG V50, and the LG V50S should all be getting Korean Android 10 betas very, very soon. So I have a Korean LG V50. I'm going to be trolling their quick help app just to try and see if I can get it preloaded. I'd love to take LG's spin on Android 10 for a test drive, see what it is that they're going to be focusing on. I'm very concerned about how they're going to handle things like gestures for some of the advanced functionality and swiping on a screen when I'm trying to use the camera that has full manual controls and lots of dials and sliders. Doesn't sound like a good fit for me. And I'll probably end up just going back to traditional Android navigation controls on a V50. But I want to see. I want to see how LG handles some of the changes coming. And again, I'd want to use my V50 with dark mode. It would be really nice. So that's good news. That's an initiative that LG has been way behind on that hopefully we'll start to see a bit more momentum on. From the Sentinel 909, if Nova does not reduce performance in any way, who cares? Not only does Nova not reduce performance, I swear to you, Nova on an LG is snappier, more fluid, and more consistent than LG's own launcher. LG's launcher is a mess. It is one of the worst launchers I think I've ever seen on any phone since, like, Froyo, since, like, Android 2. I show it in my V50 long-term review. I go back to the home launcher, and I'm on the home screen, and I flip to, like, open the app drawer, and it overlays the app. It stutters. First of all, it stutters, just doing something basic like opening the app drawer, and then it overlays the apps on top of the launcher, glitches, and then smoothly goes into the rest of the launcher. I absolutely hate a vertical swipe to open an app drawer and horizontal swipes to then page through an app drawer. I just want it to be one continuous list. Give me one gesture. Because another thing that's really going to piss me off is lateral swipes when that's the gesture that we use as a back button. Pisses me off. I don't want the same gesture to do two different things on one phone. Drives me nuts. But then the last thing, the last nail in the coffin, and I really feel like this should upset more people on LG phones. When you install new apps, the app drawer cannot stay alphabetized. So if you go into your LG launcher and you say, alphabetize my apps, it'll do it once. Then if you install an app, if you uninstall an app, it just adds it to the end of the list or leaves a hole where that app used to live. It won't reorganize your app drawer. Every single time you install or uninstall, you have to manually re-alphabetize. Again, pants on head, dumb. As soon as you install Nova Launcher, your phone will be smoother, sleeker, faster, more responsive, and you can dictate what direction your app drawer goes in. The only correct answer is vertical. Anyone who says they like a lateral app drawer is not good with gadgets. I'm sorry. You make poor life decisions. I still love you like a sibling, but I feel you should hear it from me. You could do better. Chatty Boy 3, Team Microsoft Launcher. The Microsoft Launcher is also very good. I am a creature of habit. I have been using Nova for years. I love the customization options in Nova, and I've got a theme that I back up. So as soon as I install a new phone, I log in, I go, hey, install my my backup of Nova, and then I'm off and running. So it will take a lot for me to switch to another type of solution. Matt Tyler, where's that ThinQ AI when you're adding apps? Apparently, alphabetizing is really hard for AI to figure out. DTNL, whoa, Juan just dissed my app drawer preference. I'm hurt. I need a falafel to feel better. I don't want to make you falafel about your app drawer. Yeah! But yes, Gary the Fireman is correct. Falafel makes everything better. I have not eaten breakfast. I'm going to be so hungry thinking about falafel now. Okay. One last story about updates. Let me get this out of the way here and get this. Oh, Matt Tyler, LG is going to be sacking you in the morning one. Actually, I have had numerous conversations with LG international PR and regional PR about some of those choices. It's out of their hands. Like, not to throw anyone under the bus, but it's not like people complaining about LG software isn't being heard. It's just LG is kind of like Samsung, and it's this humongous organization, and some of their recent difficulties, it takes a long time for that ship to correct course. And often when you look at what fixing a problem might cost versus their current position in the sales market, I feel like there are some decisions that are being made to focus on other things. If LG is making the choice to minimize developer costs, but they still want to include a quad DAC on a phone, I'm happy to install Nova Launcher on an LG and plug in my amazing headphones and shoot the best video on any Android platform, rivaling the iPhone 11 Pro. And I'm fine. Like, I'm fine with an update taking a little longer to get to my phone, and I'm fine with the UI being absolute garbage because I can fix that. If LG's looking at their financials and they say, oh, well, let's get rid of the quad DAC and then put that, you know, obviously it's not a one-to-one for money. I could go on. So, let me get this out of the way here. From Braden, LG PR is just bad. I haven't seen an ad in years. I'm very disappointed in LG's ad buys. I know a number of people, like, again, it's hard for me to be impartial here because I know quite a few LG PR reps, and some of them I followed from a number of different companies. Again, when you start working with some of these people, it's hard to take the individual out of the equation for the whole company. There are so many amazing people working LG PR, but they've also got mandates from LG corporate on what they can and can't do and how much money they can spend on things. So it's tough. I mean, this stuff is not easy, and it's way more complicated than I think general consumers understand, especially when you start getting into regional contracts with carriers and distribution. And it's something that I think LG definitely needs to work on over the next year or three. But it's not going to happen right away. For as much as I want them to succeed in the market, the realities of moving a ship as big as LG is very sensitive. It's very nuanced. Get this out of the way here. Oh, so like from Dumour's point, LG should do an LG G8-1, like how they did the LG G7-1. Yes, the problem is the LG G7-1 still had a bunch of compromises. Over an LG G7. Again, it's hard to express. It's the same reason why I get frustrated with people who complain about EMUI on Huawei phones. You're complaining about the colors of the skin on the front of the UI, but you're not paying attention to the huge amount of customization that runs underneath and some of the things that EMUI has done so well that now Google is trying to rip it off for Android. And it's the same thing with LG. That quad DAC is not a part of the Qualcomm chipset. So everything about the headphone experience and the DTS 3D support and the high-res audio capabilities and MQA and the tuning and the EQ, control over the amp so that you don't blow out your ears or destroy your headphones, all of that has to be custom software. It's easy to say we should just run Android One, but I don't think LG could. And still have all of the underpinnings and still keep up with distribution. I mean, look at the Nokia 9. That's an Android One phone. It might get Android 10 in the next month. Right now, Nokia is talking about the Nokia 8. They're not too vocal about the Nokia 9. And why? Because there is so much custom software that has to happen for that camera to function. And just flipping the switch from Android 9 to Android 10 is much more difficult on a phone like that. So it's, again, it's tricky stuff, and it is. It's a lot more complicated than I think we give it credit for. All right, I'm sorry. I've rambled on too long. One other update story. This one I thought was a little disappointing. Samsung is pushing out betas for Android 10 updates. They're delaying I believe they're delaying the update for the Galaxy S10. But it should still arrive soon-ish. I think it's even money if we really get good Android 10 on a Galaxy S10 before we hear about a Galaxy S11. Womp womp. But they are doing their traditional Samsung thing and cutting a feature out of their next operating system update. When we went from Android 8 to Android 9, Samsung gutted all of the advanced camera modes. In another blow to enthusiasts, Samsung won't support Linux on Dex once Android 10 arrives. This is by way of Engadget, written up by John Fingus. If you've been using Linux on Dex, aka Linux on Galaxy, to turn your Samsung phone into a PC, you'll need to make a change of plans. Samsung is warning users that it's shutting down the Linux on Dex program and that its Android 10 update won't support using the open source OS as a desktop environment. The company did not explain why it was shutting things down, but it did note that the Android 10 beta is already going without the Linux option. Hey, podcast listeners, I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon and my Audible campaign, I can hook you up with a $20 voucher if you're shopping a new OnePlus, or you can grab a ton of great video games for cheap with Humble Bundle Monthly. I also have a teaser image on that page for my upcoming Mega Pickle coffee mug, which will hopefully be available for purchase soon. SomeGadgetGuy.com, link at the top of the site, support Some Gadget Guy, and hopefully you find something cool, something you might like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch. So, again, I feel this is still confirming one of my feelings that I got a lot of pushback during my LG G8 review, that LG is actually better at software than people give them credit for, but they're not very good at the major operating system updates. Samsung is still pretty terrible at the major operating system update, but at least they get them out faster than LG. But I think Samsung's current direction is whittling back on some of the tech enthusiasm scene, some of that more aggressive use, some of that more exciting capability, and they're going for a more mainstream audience argument. When you whittle back camera features, when you get rid of a feature like Linux on Dex, that to me says that they're walking away from the more experimental scene. They're walking away from the heavy use enthusiast scene. That's kind of disappointing. I don't want to buy a Samsung phone and then run a feature like Linux on Dex. Like I am a passionate advocate for using desktop modes in our phones. And I think over the next 3 years, your phone will very quickly outpace nice consumer laptops in your capability and in your use. But if you wanted to have the choice of running a Linux environment through that kind of portal, Samsung is going to be taking that away from you. I find that to be very disappointing. You bought a Galaxy S10, maybe you started using some features like Dex, and now Samsung is going to whittle back on what your actual capabilities are. I don't think Samsung gets enough criticism for these recent changes in the perception of their products. Like, we're still going with this idea that Samsung is this, like, everything in the kitchen sink, disruptive player. They're doing things to fight Apple, and they make fun of Apple for not having these features, and you're going to get everything, even raw technologies. Man, your Galaxy is going to be packed. Except on a Note 10, you're going to lose Linux support. You don't have a headphone jack. You don't have any advanced manual camera features. Increasingly, step by step, Samsung is becoming more like Apple. Their major recent business moves have been very similar to Apple business moves. Again, I would like to see Samsung engage in market disruption, not sort of acquiescing to the whims of what's popular with iPhones. Rosted, I think spring of 2020, and I'm assuming he means for the Android 10 update. Oh, Abraham Artemis. We can do it because we can. So suck it. I mean, what else are you going to do? According to tech enthusiasts, there is no other company to consider. It's only Samsung and it's only Apple. Those are the only gadgets worth buying. The Sentinel 909, I'm getting a strong why enthusiast brands will betray you vibe. Tech Alter, amazing YouTube channel. That video alone, like if you haven't seen that video and you're a fan, if you're a tech enthusiast, if you really enjoy the discussion, the analysis of this type of stuff, that is a video you need to watch five times and write a report on. He absolutely nails that flow of upstart company, disruptive company, price competitive, gaining popularity, building a fan base, and then shifting into a mainstream audience type of market segment. Yeah, I'm getting that feeling with Samsung a lot, which sucks because, again, I always have a Note 4 within reach. I always turned to the Note to be that phone, the phone that packed everything in. It would always be the complete package of every, you know, top of the line, modern, bleeding edge technology. And I just don't think that that's true anymore. And I think Samsung is coasting on that reputation instead of really fulfilling that reputation. I got to take another drink here. This is a delicious coffee mug. Matt Tyler, your Megapickle mug is being printed. It's not in the mail yet. It's going to take like 2 weeks at least to get to you. But I did get the notification that your Megapickle mug is shipping. This is really good. That is the most delicious pickle-themed coffee mug that you can buy on the internet. So Zalbotnik, this is kind of the point that I'm talking about with enthusiast features. Maybe people didn't use it enough and they didn't want to invest in it anymore. I think that's an entirely appropriate reaction. And it's very likely true. They have market data that people who use DeX are probably a very small subset of general Galaxy consumers. And of those people who use DeX, again, probably only another small collection were using, Linux on DeX. My problem is when you remove a feature from a phone that's out in active circulation, if you didn't want to include advanced camera settings on the Galaxy S11, I think that's fine. But when the Galaxy Note 9 has advanced camera functionality and then it gets an update and you remove it, that's where I have a very fundamental problem with that as a business practice. Like, to me, that's worthy of discussing the potential of a class action lawsuit. Like when the PS3 launched and it had the ability to sort of, load Linux and had a whole separate coprocessor for backwards compatibility with the PS2, at one point, Sony pulled Linux support because future PlayStation 3s lacked the ability to do that. So someone who had a PS3 that had that functionality, I think they rightfully had a claim for a class action lawsuit, and we saw one pop up against Sony. When you remove features that someone paid for, I don't really care that much if, well, not enough people were using them, so we took them away from everybody. That to me is terrible, is a terrible corporate philosophy. And it makes me concerned over what type of functionality and what type of long-term use will I have with a Galaxy. Will I fall in love with a feature on a Galaxy and then they'll take it away because I'm a nerd and I use my phones in a more aggressive fashion than general average consumers? To me, that should be a fear point moving forward for any Galaxy purchase. Do you like this feature? Better hope it's popular because Samsung might take it away. Like that's garbage. I don't want to do business that way. Do 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 do. couple other comments in here. Sorry, there's a thread happening about, I think, other... Oh, someone talking about the Atrix and desktop modes. Again, like, I think it's coming. Give it another year or two for better hardware. And what I can show you on the Pixel 4 should make you very interested in using your phone for laptop style use. Okay. From Zalbotnik, I didn't realize they did this on existing products was a way to grab dinner. That's indeed BS. Don't include it on the Galaxy S11, but don't take it away if someone was using it on the Galaxy S10. That's what I find most troubling. Okay, so there is a huge explosion of Pixel 4 videos hitting the internet right now. And unsurprisingly, that's reflected on the subreddit this week. I have been trying to find ways to help encourage and promote a greater diversity of tech commentary, of conversations online, and broaching a wider, a broader range of topics than just Apple and Samsung do good for SEO on YouTube. So a couple years back, I started a subreddit. I let it lapse. I cleaned it all up, gave it a fresh coat of polish, and it's starting to build its own organic community of people that feel the same way. They want to support content creators. They want to find new voices in the tech space. So you can participate too. It's open to everybody. You can promote your own videos, which is usually a big no-no on other Reddit communities. Like, we want to find new things, but you can't share your own video and we'll block you from the subreddit if you abuse our rules. On reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, if you want to share your own video, you can share your own video. If you would like to help support someone that's building a channel, you can support them. Or if you just want to try and help boost a content creator who's maybe not doing as well. There are channels out there that used to perform really, really well. Now they're not doing so hot. I was bringing up at the beginning of creating the subreddit, I was bringing up Tech Thing. Patrick Norton is an amazing voice in the technology space. He was producing a weekly show, a phenomenal, high production value show, and every week he could maybe get like 20,000 views. That's terrible. I want those old school tech TV G4 kinds of shows. It's sort of a variety show every week of cool security topics and fun things to do with software. And here's a wacky gadget that I used. And here's a headphone review. Like, diversity on YouTube from one channel or across the entire tech community is in a really sad state right now. So the only thing we can do is we need to fix it ourselves. We need to be supporting, sharing, commenting, engaging with content creators that are making things that we want to see. And it's not enough to just passively view and shrug and say, well, it was a good video. I hope he makes more. Because that's not really going to get you good content moving forward. Reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. It's one attempt, my attempt at trying to help. It's never going to be a front page subreddit. It's never going to be a top subreddit. Just the whole mission of this is to find new content. But we're already seeing every week we have new subscribers, new members. It's very exciting to see. The first week of this month, we did more traffic than the whole of last month. That to me says that there is an interest in trying to find and in trying to support this type of distribution. So without further ado, the top stories on our glowing rectangles, I'm going to play around with this just a little bit. Obviously, the Pixel hit heavy. And I was excited to see that the Pixel hit heavier than, say, the last iPhone launch. The last iPhone launch, we saw iPhone videos, but they weren't consistently bumped up to the top of the subreddit. So when we look at the top stories this week, let me go into screen share again. I actually made it to the top of my own subreddit. That doesn't happen very often. But my hopes and fears video is currently the top pick. But immediately after that, top five Pixel 4 complaints from Josh Vergara. Josh lays out some great analysis on what he's concerned about with the Pixel 4 launch. And immediately after that, we've got Zach Talks Tech. Also, with his concerns and how he feels the Pixel 4 XL is a letdown. Top three stories, Pixel 4 focused. But now I kind of want to show what happened immediately after that first batch of top stories, because this video should be doing much better traffic. Easy Computer Solutions, Filmic Pro versus Samsung stock camera app, a pro mode versus an auto mode. I'd really like people to check this out. Easy has been doing these camera showdowns and these camera comparisons for a while. This is exactly the kind of conversation we just had about Samsung. What do you need to do to fix what Samsung cuts out of your phone if you liked those features? And the thing about Filmic, you can't ever get completely back to the full functionality of a first-party camera app, but you can get pretty close. So I'd really like everyone to go out there, give this video a view, especially if you're into mobile cameras, mobile photography, stuff like that, and hit them up with a comment. I mean, that's exactly the kind of commentary, that's exactly the kind of analysis I want to see more of. And that is a big benefit to Samsung users out there who might have been blindsided by getting an update on their phone that then removed functionality. They'll probably still end up buying another Samsung and getting used to it, but at least when they do, there's an option to restore some of what Samsung cut out. And then right after that, we've got a Realme X2 Pro review from techtablets.com and a smaller channel, In-Depth Tech Reviews, only 7,000 subscribers, talking about the Pixel 4 event. That was posted near a couple days ago. But again, an expanded conversation. We've got stories on the Galaxy Fold near the top. Oh, this is a huge one. MedTech. This one was really cool. Josh Vergara sharing his experiences with a needle-free blood glucose reading at Create Tech 2019. I am very much in tune with the diabetes community because of some family members. That was not... So I'm subscribed to Josh. I smashed that bell icon. I didn't get a notification on a video from him talking about medical tech. But it was one of the higher voted stories on Glowing Rectangles. So again, finding this stuff, if you only go through your YouTube feed, you're only going to see manipulated search for the most popular trending topics. If you go to another community, you'll find that diversity. You'll find a broader collection of viewpoints, more pros and cons, and more gadgets to dig into, more gadgets to examine. So that's my plug. Reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. An amazing collection. Every week I'm so proud of the community for supporting and promoting interesting and engaging content. And every week I put out this promise. If you haven't checked out the subreddit, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, if you haven't been there, I guarantee you, you will find someone you've never seen before that will become one of your new favorite channels. I have no money back guarantee because it's run totally free. LFA reviews at the top of the subreddit, hashtag some jerk with a hat. Matt Tyler, hashtag some punchable face guy is on top. I hate that guy's face. He's all like, I like phones that are different, and you should punch me in the mouth. I'm gadget guy. Sorry, it's a long-running joke. It's a long-running inside joke with my podcast audience. That's hilarious. But yeah, I hate that guy's face. from Brayden, I don't get any notifications from you. Google, I've been hearing from a lot of people. Ever since I got demonetized, I don't think I really show up in notifications on YouTube anymore. Sentinel909, dude, I'm subscribed to Josh and I never saw that vid. Josh has been very, his lifestyle commentary is phenomenal. One, he's just a philosophical kid. I like that he's got a young person's old soul approach to talking about technology, but he's also just been really upfront talking about some of his own health concerns. And lifestyle changes can be pretty dramatic, especially when you're a little younger. And being able to share something like that, we have this platform. I can make a video, I can share it. Unfortunately, when I share that video, YouTube acts as a middleman to try and dictate what's going to be popular and what's going to keep people watching on YouTube longer. I guarantee you, people who are subscribed to Josh Vergara care about Josh. And they care about Josh more than they care about Samsung or Apple. They subscribe to Josh's channel because Josh is an engaging figure in tech discussion. And he's sharing personal accounts of using this stuff. And that's what I think YouTube has completely failed on. If you're following a channel like mine, you probably don't care about an individual manufacturer. You just think I'm a big dork and you like to laugh at me. And that's kind of the whole shtick of me getting wiggy, soapboxy, and wagging my fist at what's a popular trend. It has very little to do with what the trending topic is that I might be talking about. LFA reviews, unsubscribe, then resubscribe and hit the bell. It worked for me. I'll give it a try. I'm just so tired of trying to jump through hoops and play the algorithm game with YouTube that I did it. I'd like YouTube to take me seriously that when Josh puts out a video, I would like to be notified that he put out a video. But here's the thing. I subscribed to my own subreddit using an RSS reader and using IFTTT, if this, then that. So when Josh puts out a new video, I get a notification from IFTTT that there is a new Josh video on the subreddit, and then I know to go and check my subreddit for what's new. And I do that with Bored at Work. I do that with Fandroid. I do that with Nothing But Tech, YT88. I mean, like, I get a ton of notifications on my phone, but I know when my favorite channels put stuff up, and I almost never see those notifications coming in from YouTube. So, yeah, it's good. I can't say your name, but a comment from someone on Twitch. Wow, RSS still exists. You know what? If you're not linking for your favorite commentators and your favorite channels, if you're not linking subscriptions with some type of RSS or IFTTT, you're missing out. And you're probably missing out on some cool stuff. And get this out of the way here. But yes, we have solutions. We can fix those problems. And then also, I've always appreciated the support, the encouragement, and the interactions on reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Don't be stingy with the upvotes. You're helping promote content. You are an active participant in trying to help a channel get monetized or trying to help a channel find new audience. If something's popular on Glowing Rectangles, there's a higher chance it'll be shared on a larger subreddit from someone trying to karma whore. It's been very encouraging. So I hope you'll check it out. I hope you'll participate. Even if you're just watching stuff, upvote, comment, share, do what you can, because it's a tough living out there for a content creator on YouTube these days. So let me get this out of the way here and get that out of the way there. Okay. So who wants to talk about the Pixel? It's Pixel. I already have coffee stains on my fabric case because I'm a slob. And I'm really disappointed about that because I only got a couple good shots of it brand new and clean. And this is a very pretty case, but it's going to age very, very quickly in my hands. I'm going to have to ask and reach out for some other bumper cases. But Pixel 4 is out. The reviews are out. Very, very similar to how I get cranky about brands like Sony, brands like LG, that because from the Pixel 2 to the Pixel 3, that because Google didn't sell enough Pixel 3s, it seemed that the tech commentary turned on the Pixel. I was very cynical about the Pixel 1 because I wrote for an Android blog at the time and I was a Nexus nerd. But we had just gone through all of those problems with the Qualcomm 808 and the Nexus 6P. The Snapdragon 810, the Qualcomm Snapdragon 810. And that chipset wrecked so many phones. Instability, boot loops, poor performance, LG G Flex 2, HTC M9, the G4, the V10, the Nexus 6P. That entire year, when someone has a negative sentiment like, oh, I couldn't go back to an LG, I had a G4. Well, that wasn't LG's fault. LG didn't handle it as well as they could have, but that was Qualcomm's fault. Did you have a Nexus boot loop or wig out on you? That was Qualcomm's fault. But again, you saw the label on the box, so I understand why the emotion, why the feelings, the negative feelings were directed at the label on the box. So we saw that surge, people excited about Google making their own flavor of an iPhone. The Pixel 2 refined that idea, but made me more frustrated because of losing the headphone jack. I'm always going to be upset about losing the headphone jack. Now it's become a necessary evil. Like, I can't just say, I'm not going to review this phone, it doesn't have a headphone jack. Because then literally I'd only be able to review the like Pixel 3a, the cool pad, the $200 cool pad legacy that I reviewed, and LG phones. Like, I'd have to skip everything else. But I'm still going to whine about it, just like I still whine about notches on my display. But somewhere in there, the Pixel 3a had had some issues, definitely had some problems with RAM management. I did not like the bathtub notch on the 3a XL. And then it just became another phone to add to the list of, these are the phones that are easy to criticize. If I'm running a tech channel, I need to dismiss concerns about Samsung's iPhones and OnePluses because those do very, very well from an SEO perspective. And I can come in and I can hammer an LG, a Sony, an HTC, a Motorola, a Google Pixel, because those fan bases are much, much smaller. So I can show that I have the tough criticisms for phones that don't sell as well, but for phones that are already very consumer popular, well, if there's a deal breaker on that phone, really you'll get used to it. It's not really a deal breaker. And that to me has become kind of the frustrating commentary of leaning into the Pixel 4. I skipped the Pixel 3 last year, so I'm going, in terms of their flagships, just in terms of Pixels, I'm going from a Pixel 2. That was my last real review of a Pixel. That's while I was still at Pocket Now. And then I went to a Pixel 3a. I did get my hands on the Pixel 3a. And that is not a phone for me, but it was a very exciting phone to use because I could very easily imagine a number of people in my circles of family and friends who would do well with that phone. And my hypothesis on that was borne out. My sister, her husband, two cousins now, four folks in my immediate vicinity of varying degrees of tech enthusiasm. My brother-in-law is much more inclined to watch tech videos and tech reviews. My cousin in New Jersey, she's not super, she doesn't care. She just wanted a good camera and she doesn't shoot video. Across the board, this has been one of the most well-received phone recommendations I've ever made. The Pixel 3a has been killing it. It's a champ of a phone. So now we've got the Pixel 4. And it's kind of a curious beast. But I find it, like I alluded to earlier in this podcast, I find it troubling that we're kind of picking what the deal breaker is based on the brand and how popular that brand might be. And when a phone excels in one category, but it's a less popular device, well, then that category doesn't matter. The Pixel 4 is the fastest phone I've run through video editing, rendering, transcoding, and stabilizing tests I've ever seen. You can catch this in my performance review. I show it on camera, and I'll have links to the actual full tests if you're worried that I'm somehow manipulating the video footage. My gaming laptop, doing a simple transcoding test, I take a 100 megabit per second video file from my Panasonic, from the camera I'm recording this on right now, and I squish that down into a 50 megabit per second 4K video file. It's a very straightforward, streamlined kind of use. It's kind of like what you would do if your camera app has basic trimming features, right? So I shoot a higher quality video. I trim the head and the tail. I compress it down a little bit. And then it's an easier video to share on YouTube or on social media. It's a slightly smaller file size. You have to suck quality out of the video to get that. It's like an MP3. But that's a very streamlined idea of use. And it's kind of what you would see in, like I said, like the trimming tool on a Galaxy or on an LG. My gaming laptop, taking that video file and using desktop grade, workstation grade video editing software, takes about a minute 20, a minute 30 to squish that 1 minute video file. My OnePlus 7T can do it in 53 seconds. So I've got a $2,000 gaming laptop with an NVIDIA graphics card. It's a beast of a machine. It's getting beat by the OnePlus 7T. 53 seconds. So it can compress that video faster than real time. The video is a minute long. It compresses it in 53 seconds. The Pixel 4 did it in 31 seconds. It's not like, oh, well, the Pixel 4 kind of beat it, but, you know, it's like, who would really notice, like, a margin of error? It's only like a second faster. 31 seconds. It's compressing a 1 minute 4K video in half the time it would take to play that 1 minute video. OnePlus does an absolutely phenomenal job of updating their software, polishing their software, optimizing the software for the hardware in their phones. And Google just spanked them. And it's not close. Because let's not forget, the OnePlus 7T is using a Snapdragon 855 Plus with 8 gigabytes of RAM. And the Pixel 4 is using a regular Snapdragon 855 with 6 gigabytes of RAM. And I don't believe the Pixel 4 is using UFS 3, but someone correct me on that. So the OnePlus is also using a higher quality and faster storage. That level of optimization costs money. Like, that's a feature, and that is performance that you need to pay for to get delivered in this phone. The only phone that has come close to this level of performance is the LG V50. And there you're talking about monster cooling hardware. And I don't believe the Pixel 4 XL is having to use enormous vapor chambers and heat pipes to get that level of performance. But it's across the board. Again, I'm comparing this because so many people have told me that because the OnePlus 7T exists and it's cheaper than a Pixel, there's no reason to buy a Pixel. But stabilization test, Pixel wins by a bit. A much more in-depth rendering test with multiple clips and transitions and a watermark, it's hilarious. The 7T pulls ahead, and then the Pixel just obliterates the OnePlus 7T. Again, if you care about screaming performance with a workload that justifies a $1,000 price tag, I've not found a faster phone for aggressive work, laptop displacement work, than the Pixel 4. So I feel that's worth celebrating. Like, that should be a feature of the phone that contributes to how the phone is priced. I've been having a really hard time with this one because I feel like we've been dancing around. Like, you know, someone came at me in a private message saying, but how can we justify the price of a Pixel 4 when it's $100 more than an iPhone 11? And I want to, like, what is it that we're comparing? Because we can't argue, well, average consumers need to have 4K 60 frame per second video, when we're also saying average users don't use things like 4K 60 frame per second video. I mean, it was only this year that Apple even gave you the ability to change the resolution and frame rate in the iPhone camera app. So even Apple isn't really making that claim on the iPhone 11. As much as tech YouTubers are now looking for, what is the data point where the iPhone 11 can win? Because I feel it's a pretty even-handed comparison. I think the Pixel 4, the smaller 64 gig, it only costs $100 more than an iPhone 11, slots in pretty well against the iPhone 11. You've got a higher resolution OLED display that runs at 90 hertz. How is that not better than the weird almost 720p display on a larger surface area and an LCD on the iPhone 11? It's a better technology. The better technology costs more. You know, like, we've got similar face unlock capabilities. Both phones start at 64 gig. Google is going to support probably almost as well as Apple will for software support, though I bet you Google does a slightly better job of keeping features up to date on the Pixel than Apple will on the iPhone. I'm still mad my iPhone XS doesn't have a night mode in the camera, even though it's totally capable of doing that. And I also know I'm going to get much better content creation use out of the Pixel 4 than I will out of the iPhone. For as much as we're talking about the camera capabilities, I don't want people to forget that in my transcoding test, if you're really making stuff on a phone, the iPhone XS was beat bad by my LG V30 for rendering and outputting high quality video. So again, it's not just, well, Apple said the A13 was the fastest, and there's the benchmark in the bar graph, so that's what it is. We need actual tests to try this stuff. It's super frustrating for me because it feels like a lot of this tech commentary has gotten really lazy. That company made a claim, okay, well, that's what we'll go with, and then they don't really investigate beyond a synthetic benchmark, which is pretty easy to game. The Pixel 4 has delivered the worst Geekbench 5 score of any Snapdragon 855 that I've reviewed. It is the lowest. It is slower than an Xperia. It is way slower than a Samsung. It's lagging real bad behind a OnePlus 7T. But when I actually fire up an app and I do aggressive work, this phone has smoked every other device. The only phone that comes close is the LG V50, which also had slightly higher mid-pack Geekbench scores. I don't have a problem with the Pixel 4. It is another collection of pros and cons, and I'm getting real tired. Tech reviewers out there now, no wide-angle camera, that's a deal breaker. Those exact same tech reviewers used to tell me that my V20, a wide-angle camera is nice. I mean, it's nice to have, but it's not necessary. People don't need a wide-angle camera. Well, now that Apple's done it, now it's a deal-breaker. I find that to be horrifically disingenuous. We could just say we would wish we would have it, but don't act like a year ago not having a wide-angle camera was a bummer, but, you know, it's okay. You just take a step back or do a panorama shot. Oh, now it doesn't have one? Now it's a deal breaker. My mind has been changed since the iPhone 11 came out. That's a bad look. That's a real bad look. And I think it's important that we remember where this stuff came from. Someone is first to market with the technology. I would like us to do a better job of celebrating the company that actually was first to market with that technology. So I don't know. We'll have to see. There's a lot going on with the Pixel 4. I definitely have some concerns. It does need an update. Battery life has been, how do I want to say this politely? Mediocre. For the capacity in the Pixel 4 XL, there is definitely something going on with the radar and the ambient display that is running that battery and waking up the phone more often than it needs to. Consistently in my battery specs, you'll see ambient display is one of the things that's drawing the most power. So I'm playing around with a couple different setups, like maybe if I disable this, but I turn that on, that'll contribute. Right now, I've just disabled the ambient display, but I've kept the radar mode where the phone detects your hand reaching for it. And that seems to be doing a little bit better from last night to this morning than the night before. But again, trying to sort out battery issues takes a long time. So So I won't have a good answer on battery life for probably another week of use as I try each of these different little permutations. And then as soon as Google puts out another update, I'm sure all of that's going to change again. The early camera reactions, very positive. Again, this is not a phone for me. I don't like every shot being this sort of crushed highlight, low light HDR. But if you're looking at an effortless, juicy color photo mode, I don't see anything holding consumers back. In fact, this is going to be one of the premier point and shoot still photo experiences on the market. I'll still fall back on my LGs because I kind of like their more understated post-processing look. But also the video is fine. 4K 30 frame per second software stabilized video looks good. I just want people to move up to 4K. I'm tired of people acting like 4K 60 is a deal breaker when I'm still struggling to get people just to stop shooting 1080p video, which should actually lead us into one of my cranky rants here. Let me scroll down and get this out of the way here. If you were, and I know, again, like I said, you follow PR people as they move to different companies. I'm going to have to have a conversation with some of the Made by Google team, because this was just a bad look. Again, it's kind of a common phrase that I'm working with right now with this phone. But Made by Google was asked about 4K video and why we don't have 4K 60 frame per second. So they tweeted this out as a reply. To Stanzillas, hi, Pixel 4 supports 4K video recording on the rear camera at 30 frames per second. We find that the majority of users stick with 1080p, so we focus our energy on improving our quality in this mode versus enabling a 4K 60 frame per second mode that could use up to half a gigabyte of storage every minute. Okay. You're not making my job here liking your phone easy, Google. You could have just like not brought up storage. If I'm going to have a criticism on the Pixel 4, it's that I wish that there were more storage options, or that there was like an iPhone style bump where instead of it going from 64 to 128, it goes from 64 to 256. Or that you make the starting storage 128 to 256 as the option. Google is doing this because they have the market data and the research, and they're trying to push cloud services and make money off of cloud services. I think this is all very clear, but it's not a deal breaker on an iPhone, so I don't think it's a deal breaker on a Pixel. There are different consumers with different needs and different wants looking at a variety of different solutions in the market. So it's a bummer for me. Even 128, lean for me. But I don't think it's this doom and gloom when, again, we're comparing the Pixel against something like the iPhone 11, where the Pixel 4, I feel, slots in really well in between an iPhone 11 and an iPhone 11 Pro. I hate to say it, but if Apple can do it, Google can too. Just, we're going to be cranky about it, and that's not great. Pardon the interruption here, but I need to plug another podcast I'm working on with my buddy Andrew. The Geek Book Club is a monthly podcast, which is also an online book club, which should not come as a surprise given the name of the podcast. We pick a book, we read it, and then we talk about it, and you can also join the conversation. If you want a good geeky chat about your favorite geek literature, join Andrew Wallace and I every month on the Geek Book Club, available on iTunes, Google Play, and other fine podcasting services. So if you're concerned, big floppy bunny ear air quotes concern, is the user experience with video eating up too much storage, you could have given us more storage options. So here's what I think is more likely. It's the same problem facing Samsung and why I think Samsung has gutted a lot of their video modes. It takes a lot of effort, it takes a lot of expense, and Qualcomm hasn't quite caught up to what Apple can do on the A12, let alone the A13, in managing video input output. It would seem to me, if I'm looking through spec on the Snapdragon 845 to the Snapdragon 855, that first of all, we're only just now getting into chipsets with any kind of actual support for multiple cameras. It was kind of a big deal on the 845 that dual camera systems were supported as well as they were. When you start getting into five cameras on a phone like the LG V50, it takes a ton of custom firmware and manipulation to get a Snapdragon chipset and Android to properly utilize all of those sensors. And it's one of the reasons why again, this is my hypothesis. This isn't like I've got insider info here. This is one of the reasons why I think on an LG, manual modes are only supported for two of the three rear cameras and for neither of the front-facing cameras. There is a limitation as to how many cameras a Snapdragon chipset can see. So if Google is really trying to work an HDR-style video effect, that means that the camera is technically overshooting. This is what I think is happening. I need more time to analyze photo and video footage. I've not shot nearly enough to say that this is the case, but this is my guess. That to make the video footage look similar to the post-processing on the stills requires you to shoot in a high compression, a high dynamic range style video compression and run that pretty aggressively, which you don't have proper support for on the Snapdragon 855. The 855 at 4K can't overcrank like that to deliver the same color, saturation, and dynamic range at 60 frames per second. So I think Google is making an obnoxious compromise because everything I've seen on the Pixel 4 camera has been to streamline the consumer interactions. Like there isn't any standalone manual control or HDR toggle on the Pixel 4 anymore. It has become the most effortless, but also the most on the rails HDR camera shooter for any phone today. I mean, like I'm going to start calling it the whoosh pop pop because the whole usage of this phone is a fast reaction. You go whoosh pop pop and then you've taken your photo and you get on with your day. We used to have that HDR toggle. That's gone. So your only option is JPEG with all of the Google full auto scene analysis, HDR, HDR plus aggressive manipulation and post-processing, or a raw file. That's what you get. Like there isn't an in-between. It's all or nothing. And I kind of feel the same thing was hitting them for video. They didn't want to confuse consumers. They didn't want to make stuff more difficult to use. And they couldn't deliver a consistent video effect. There would have had to have been a setting in the camera app that I don't think Google wanted to include. So you have 4K video with software. Let me rephrase. You have 4K video, 30 frames per second with software stabilization and some kind of high dynamic range. Or you have 4K video at 60 frames per second without that more HDR dynamic range effect. And that would be a toggle in the advanced settings of your camera. And I think Google just shrugged it off. The whole point of this camera has been to get rid of all of those deeper dive camera modes, camera options, camera settings. This thing is super streamlined. So yeah. Storage is a bummer. It's still easier to move storage off of an Android phone than an iPhone, but I get that. Not having full quality backups, that's definitely a bummer if you liked that on the Pixel previously. I use OneDrive for all of my storage, so I don't complain too much. It reeks to me if you've turned 4K 60 frame per second video into a deal breaker, but you weren't really promoting that on previous phones with any focus or with any like push. Again, the iPhone can now software stabilize 60 frame per second video. So now it's worth it. I've been shooting 4K 60 frame per second on last year's LGs. It looks really good. Even with just the hardware stabilization, it floats a bit more, but that was usable video footage. I've been using a ton of that video footage. So this is what I'm getting increasingly frustrated by is this cherry picking. The Pixel 4 optimizes and uses its hardware better than any other phone that I've tested this year. And that's going to be dismissed because the Geekbench score is low and it doesn't have a wide angle camera. And I don't really feel like that's a fair conversation about this phone. So, from Goran Petrovic, Juan, pay attention to battery life on the Pixel 4. I'm interested in your opinion. I really wanted to try the smaller Pixel 4 with the smaller battery just to see if that was really going to be as bad as people were saying it would be. Usage is a huge concern. The screen, I think, again, with what they're doing with radar, Google needs to address some of those issues. We're already going to see it. They've already said that there's going to be a fix for the face unlock. So you can toggle a setting so that it has to see your eyes. Like there has to be some attention paid to the phone so that someone can't unlock the phone if you're asleep. So I think we'll see that very, very soon. And around that same time, I hope they'll also improve some of the interactions with radar and face unlock, because I think that's waking the phone up more than it really needs to. But again, we're always going to see a battery life deficit on the Pixel, given its battery capacity over similar phones, just because of that 90 hertz refresh rate display. When you increase the number of images being sent to the screen by 50%, you will burn more of that phone's battery. And like I've said on OnePlus phones, I know it tanks my battery life, but it's pretty and I'm a grown up. So I'd rather have the option and occasionally disable it when I want better battery life than not have the option because it's really pretty. So that to me I want this to be a more well-rounded discussion on the phone, because I don't see anything that's really screaming major deal breaker. What I am having a problem determining, and what I'm going to have a lot of conversations on this phone. I'm going to be writing some articles about this phone. And then for when I put together a full video review, is who is the right consumer for this phone? I don't think I've used a phone this year that didn't get a purchasing recommendation. The Xperia 1, amazing phone. The CoolPad Legacy, awesome phone. Pixel 3a, LG G8. Galaxy S10e, various OnePlus phones. I've gotten too many OnePlus phones this year. Every phone I've used has had a purchasing recommendation, has been recommended. The issue is finding who is the right fit for that phone. And right now, this like, oh, I'm so disappointed in this phone, it's a deal breaker, you shouldn't buy it, is totally leaning into the YouTube SEO nonsense. Like when Marquez puts out an LG G8 examination video, which is basically just a thinly veiled advertisement for a Galaxy S10, that's not an honest discussion of the G8. And I'm feeling like a lot of Pixel 4 videos are pointing to, well, a OnePlus has these better specs on paper, so you should buy that instead, as opposed to an honest examination of what the Pixel 4 can really do. So I have been rambling for a while. This podcast has run over. I'm going to take another drink of water here. There's been a ton of activity in the chat. I am so sorry that I have not been addressing individual comments as much. If you have questions, if you have concerns, please repeat any comments that you put in, and we'll try and wrap this up here in about 10 minutes. But so far, my impressions of the Pixel 4, it's another nice premium phone, and if you don't see the value in it, then you should shop a different premium phone, or more likely, and what I'm telling many, many more people this year, is you should probably stop shopping premium phones if you're not looking to get premium use out of them. If you're shopping a phone and you don't have interest in replacing laptop use with your phone, then you should be looking at some of these lower cost mid-rangers as your daily driver. Again, a Pixel 3a at around $300, $350 now is almost exactly the same in the hand if you're checking your email, text messaging, just shooting a couple random snapshotty photos in good light, and communicating on social media. At half the price of your Pixel 4, it's the same experience, because all of your daily driver social media communication needs can be fulfilled for $300. So let's stop pretending that average general consumers who don't do things with their phones need to hear about how a $1,000 phone is going to change anything that they do. Because they're gonna get that $1,000 phone and they're going to use it exactly the same way that they used their last phone. I got to switch from one Megapickle-themed coffee mug to the other Megapickle-themed coffee mug. Oh, yeah, it's good. All right. So what do we got? What are you guys worried about? What do you guys care about? Battery life, obviously a big concern. I'm cranky about Face Unlock. I don't think this is going to be the phone that's going to sell me on Face Unlock as the only biometric solution. It's worth bringing up. I'm just going to show it, but I'm not going to talk about it too long. CNET did this article. Google's Pixel 4 turns up the heat on Android rivals, but not because of its camera. And it's this diatribe about how we finally have an Android phone that can compete with the iPhone for secure face unlock. And that's going to put other manufacturers on notice. And nowhere in the article does it mention the LG G8, which has secure palm unlock, secure face unlock, and a dedicated fingerprint sensor to cover all of your bases. Nor does it bring up any of the Huawei phones that have utilized similar technologies for face unlock as to what Apple is using. Again, it only happened because Google put out that notice, and now Android finally has a face unlock competitor. We got to do better at really remembering where this stuff comes from, folks. LFA reviews. Feel free to mod me so I can clean up the troll comments. Are we getting? I'm sorry, folks. Like I said, I kind of went deep on this stuff, but let's see. How do I? I'm gonna have to look it up on Twitch. I can't do it during the live stream. I don't know how to make someone a mod. I'm sorry. If there were some obnoxious comments, please let me know. And I'll try and do a better job of monitoring the stream again. But let's see. Going through some comments. Let's see. From Braden, the Pixel 4's motion sense apparently doesn't work well because the original Soli sensor was bigger and the learning it did when it was being worked on for the 2 wouldn't work for the newer, smaller Soli sensor. Really, I think they're just slow playing, and I think this is important. I'd be curious to see what what other applications we might have been able to fit a radar sensor into a mobile device without a serious impact to design or battery life. My early experiences with the sensor on the Pixel 4 have been very positive. I wish it could do more. But the actual implementation they started with was correct. The LG G8 does a lot more with its time of flight air gesture, but you have to nail the choreography. I'm pretty good at it, but it's still a higher failure rate than I would want for those interactions where I can just pick up the phone and do something faster than activate, move, gesture, twist, and flip. I think Google was correct. Introducing Soli and radar with a limited set of interactions is going to get consumers more comfortable with it. But it is starting to feel a little like Apple's 3D Touch. Again, we're quietly getting rid of 3D Touch on iPhones. I hate iOS 13 on my iPhone XS because it's basically just turned 3D Touch into long presses. But where I'm excited for the potential of air gestures and interactions with the Pixel 4, I'm worried that if Google doesn't aggressively bring new services and new features to the table, that it's going to be a forgotten feature, and it's going to turn into 3D touch. Matt Tyler, I'm pissed I won't be getting desktop mode in the Android 10 update. Pixel 4 is looking good to me for a second phone if I can get one. I'm also concerned about this too. I haven't had much time to play with it, but I can't get an HDMI out on the Pixel 4. I'm really hoping they do actually have full support for USB 3 on that. We'll have to see how that goes. Let me see this here. Get this out of the way. Okay. From Mighty Morphin Simba on Periscope, what should be the minimum battery capacity on flagships? I don't know that we need to set one. Back in the day with the Pixel 2, it was the Pixel 2 and the Xperia XE1 Compact both did fine as daily driver phones with 2700 milliamp hour capacity batteries. Like, they were good. They were fine daily driver phones. I think what's always going to be critical is the examination of form factor, target demo, and expected use. A smaller phone will likely have less intense multimedia use than a larger screened phone. I think that makes sense. So from a cost savings perspective, it's disappointing, but it's not surprising that Google went with a smaller battery. I get it. Now, what's going to be critical is balancing that expected use against features like a 90 hertz display, where I really hope I can get my hands on a smaller Pixel because I really want to test that out. From Ant16, I don't like Samsung, but what about when iris scanning was a thing? Wasn't that more secure than face unlock? I read a white paper that was compromised at one point. I can't remember the details on that. The problem with iris scanning, I don't believe, was overall security concerns. Like, I think it's probably safer than their current solution for in-display fingerprint sensors. It did become an issue with mixed lighting usage and, again, having to nail a very specific type of use. Like, you have to nail the choreography and line up your eyes, and then it unlocks the phone. And I can understand, like, again, consumers are always going to want that balance between convenience and security. And I feel like improving iris scanning and making it more secure and making it better still would have flown in the face of consumers have to really engage with the security of that device to get it to work properly. I am still annoyed by face unlock, you know, like, not unlocked. I've got to move it and make a deliberate action to my face. Whereas on a fingerprint sensor phone, I unlock it. You know, I tap the back of the phone. It unlocks. It doesn't matter if I'm looking at it. It doesn't matter if I'm pulling it out of my pocket. It's ready to go without me engaging with the security of the device. And I think that's what kind of burned Samsung on iris scanning. Let's see. Aditi Anil, YouTube is apparently doing another spam account cleanup. You get any notifications for that? Travis MCP posted on Twitter. I haven't seen anything on that. And I'm hoping that my subscriber base won't be too affected. The last major cleanup they did of spam accounts affected my channel, I think, 10 accounts. Like, I think I dropped 10 subscriptions the last time they did a major cleanup. So I'm hoping that I'm not being followed by a bunch of dumb bots. Abraham Artemis, a 5.5 inch to 5.7 inch phone with a 2:1 aspect ratio is basically the way to go for form factor for me. Large enough for enjoying content, but also small enough so I can handle it nicely. I would love to get back to an LG G6 form factor and still have all of the features and benefits that I like on a modern handset. Oh, a bunch of people talking about HTC and cryptocurrency phones. Come on. I don't know that that's a thing. And apparently, if you Bitcoin, then the IRS can still come after you. So I don't know that the Exodus is really going to be the jam. So I think it's probably about time to start wrapping this up. The conversation on the Pixel 4 is going to be very nuanced. There are things on the phone that are already very concerning to me in how I like to use my phones. I've had a number of comments saying like, hey, what phone would you use as your daily driver? And I mean, come on, you guys know it's going to be real hard in this current tech age for any company to make me want to put down an LG V series phone. I want to see how things improve. Right now, there are some compatibility issues with some of my favorite apps. Filmic is currently crashing on the Pixel. Let me just see if anything's changed. I don't think there's been an update this morning. It would be nice if there was like a Plex Netflix. Oh, actually, the Plex update, that might help too. My Plex streaming has been a little wonky on the Pixel 4, so I'm going to have to update that. But yeah, so no updates on Filmic. Unfortunately, when I try to add those, so here's Filmic and I tap on it and nothing. So this is always the bummer when a manufacturer cuts modes out of the camera, is now you have to use a third-party app which has to build compatibility per phone. So Filmic works great on Samsungs. It's gotten a lot better on OnePluses. It's going to be a while, I feel, before they start updating Pixels and LGs. On an LG, that's fine, because LG has a better camera app than Filmic. On a Pixel, that's going to be a big gap in what this phone can do. So it's things like that that are always going to be a little bit concerning. But so far, screaming fast performance, great daily driver stuff. Again, I was fine with a Pixel 3a for all my daily driver stuff. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that I've got an early impression on. Battery life, like I said, has been kind of mediocre, but has gotten better with adjusting some of the settings for the radar and the ambient display. The screen is gorgeous. Again, quad HD. This is another exciting one. Quad HD, 90 hertz refresh. It's a P-OLED. It's not an AMOLED, which means, fingers crossed, that this is an LG manufactured display and that we'll get this next year on the LG G9 and the LG V60. The screen is really pretty. I like it a lot. I want this so bad on an LG V. So yeah, good times. Real good times. And if anyone is better at the Twitch, I honestly should have looked this up before now. If someone can shoot me, I should know how to do this, but I can't figure out how to make someone a mod. I have so many people in here that have been phenomenal contributors to this podcast and to the Patreon and to my videos on YouTube that I'd like to extend that. I mean, I did that much better on YouTube, and I should probably be doing that better here too. And again, apologies if I missed anyone was being a brat in the live chat. This live chat is too important to me to let it go unmoderated. So lots more to talk about. I'm going to have an editorial talking about value and why I think it's silly. But the main point I want to get across, I love using cars as a metaphor for talking about phones. And I think our tech market would be dead. It would be horrifically unhealthy if we continue this only two phones can really be the winners of any given year. And that's based on YouTube's SEO. So whatever phones are most popular on YouTube search get to be the phones that win a discussion. More, I really want phones to look a little bit more like laptops. Tell me what laptop wins. I don't think you can. If I were to ask what Lenovo laptop wins, I don't think you could. What Asus laptop is the winner of 2019? There's so much variety and so many different user considerations. That's what I want to see for phones. If you have $50,000, if you have between, like around $50,000 to spend on a car, you could buy a Jeep. Like you could buy a Jeep Wrangler Rubicon. You could get a base model Mustang. You could get like a GMC Sierra, you know, like a 1500. You could get a bunch of different vehicles for $50,000. No one would ever in their right mind say, hey, I'm thinking of buying a Jeep. Well, for the same price, you can get a stripped down Mercedes E-Class. That person would be a douche. And we would rightfully be allowed to punch that person in the face for wasting time in a discussion like that. So when we're getting into phones, if we want a healthy and vibrant smartphone market, I want those options. I want a premium phone that's like a little hot rod roadster. I used to get phones like that. The Xperia XZ1 Compact had a bunch of compromises, but it was focused on a very particular kind of streamlined, quick interaction, snappy use. And that phone today is still one of the best Mighty Mouse phones that you can use. Even with its Snapdragon 835, oh, it's so slow. It's not. It's the screamer little phone. And it got great battery life, even though the battery was smaller, because it's a smaller phone. So it was. It made sense that that was a slightly higher priced product. A lot of care and attention and engineering went into it. And the same thing, like I want there to be a great market for Xiaomi. But the few Xiaomis I've handled don't have the same kind of polish and attention to details as this Pixel 4 has shown. Is that going to be worth $400, a $400 higher price tag to you? Probably not if you're a gadget enthusiast. But I can't take that phone to a family member of mine who wants that nice feeling and wants that support and wants, you know, to know that their warranty is in the United States and that they can get support at a carrier store for that product. I can't take them a $400 Xiaomi just because it uses the same chipset. And I'm pretty inclined to say I doubt that the chipset, the 855 in a Xiaomi, is going to be as well optimized as what I can show on the Pixel 4. So that optimization also incurs costs. Again, we need to have, I need my roadster, I need my exotic supercar. The V50 is my big old fat heavy diesel truck, you know, not the sexiest, not the prettiest, but damn, it gets the most amount of work done across all areas. You know, like we need these different options. I need a minivan. I need a sport utility vehicle. I need a respectable sedan, a fleet vehicle for, you know, a company to lease to their employees. I need all of these things. So that's what I'm hoping to glean, to get out of to get out of this Pixel 4 review. I just want to find who's the right fit for this phone, because I think a lot of people out there are going to do well by it, but not if they're only listening to YouTubers complain about a wide angle camera. That's not going to be it, because when I was out there celebrating the wide angle camera, I was told that wasn't a necessary feature. So I'm cranky. Oh, and Gary the Fireman got his buds. Gary the Fireman won our mystery contest. He was part of the Share Squad a couple weeks back, and he got himself some OnePlus wireless bullets, the limited edition olive green wireless bullets. Couldn't go to a better dude. Gary the Fireman's a good guy. And again, thank you for supporting this channel, for joining these discussions and sharing videos when I put them out there. So much respect, much love. And now, let's properly end this podcast. Gary the Fireman. Dude, they sound awesome. Triple driver neckband earbuds. OnePlus did real well. I wish the bass could come in a little fuller. But again, you can tweak the EQ. You can get some of that back. Those Knowles drivers, the balanced arms, really articulate. If you're into the mid-range and you like, especially if you like classical recordings, jazz, open air kinds of recordings, oh, the mids on those were so nice. Okay, so folks, plenty more coming on the Pixel 4. Lots of cranky Juan. Don't worry, I'm not gonna, you know, get less cranky on you. If you have recommendations for some testing, please send them my way. I want more real world testing in gadget reviews. I'm obviously going to lean towards content creation as a heavy workload, but what are some other things that we can use to test these devices? Because benchmarks are not showing us the full story. Benchmarks are not getting the job done when a Geekbench score can be this low, but the performance in a video rendering test is shockingly high. And then from there, I'm going to have another headphone review out very, very soon. I've got another tips and tricks video, and I'm almost done with that parent's guide to microtransactions video. I've had to change a few things and reshoot a couple things because it's taken me so long to do this that other new gambling mechanics have popped up in video games since then. So lots coming up, and it's my daughter's birthday this week, so I might be a little quiet in the traditional YouTube space, but SomeGadgetGuy.com, the Patreon, patreon.com/SomeGadgetGuy, be on the lookout for some fun stuff because I also want to do something fun for Halloween. I just don't know what to do just yet. So, folks, thanks so much for watching, for sharing, for subscribing, for supporting. Support your local content creators. You can not just for my channel. I absolutely love and appreciate everyone that helps on my channel, but also for everyone else that's out there that's making cool stuff on the internet. Be an active participant for the channels you care about, the Twitch streamers, the YouTubers, the editorialists, the writers. They all need some love right now because it's pretty rough. And we're getting into the end of the year where we know there's going to be a glut of holiday buying guides and, you know, what to get for that family member. And a lot of the people who are writing those articles probably don't want to be writing those articles. So when they put out something cool, make sure you're spreading the word on the stuff that they make. It's going to help them out a lot. Again, I can't tell you, even at the tier that I'm at, every single time I see a notification on a share, that helps. I see it. I can't always reply. I can't always thank individually, but no, I see every time someone's out there trying to help spread the word, and it means the world to me. And again, for this live chat, thank you so much for joining the conversation actively. If you're catching the audio review, the audio podcast after the fact, please give it a share, a like, a review on whatever podcast streaming service you might be inclined to use. That helps tremendously there too. And folks, I'll catch you back here next week. You know where to find me, Monday mornings, 9 a.m. Pacific time. We're going to talk more news. We're going to talk more gadgets. We're going to have more stuff to share. And it'll be a fun community having that conversation. So I hope to see you there. I want you all to have a fantastic week using your technology. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I'll catch you back here for next week's show. Another Monday Morning Tech Chat SGG QA podcast. I love you all. Take care.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.